God, Yahweh. It's musical instruction.
Book of Lamentations. Left off in chapter 3, verse 1. I am the man that hath seen affliction by the rod of his wrath. Now, first of all, this represents Jeremiah, since he's speaking this, but then also pointing to Christ. This chapter also speaks of we in verse 22. Those who've undergone affliction. And in verses 40 through 47. And this shows that there is an application to the saints also. There is a remnant that will pray this in Babylon. Also the Jews at the end time in Jacob's trouble. Perhaps the man-child too. Talks about the church at the end time being bowed over. It applies to the New Testament man-child learning obedience through his sufferings, just the same way that Christ did. That's why he's a picture for us. We need to see that. The affliction here, it's not only seen, but it's experienced. This word shows misery and suffering. This affliction, you've seen it, but also experienced it. It shows that Jeremiah experienced in his ministry affliction, and it wasn't easy. The cost for God's heart is great. It really is. It costs a lot. It costs you all of yourself to be poured out for Him. It also shows Christ, whose ministry culminated on the cross, the rod of affliction upon Him, and His wrath. Compare Isaiah chapter 53, verse 7 here. The rod of His wrath. When you compare Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5, you find that this speaks of Babylon. Now, when you take the spiritual application, see here it's speaking of a man and the man representing Israel. Spiritual application is Christ, and so it represents the cross. That's the rod that was used as his affliction. Jesus, facing God's wrath, came on the cross. He faced that wrath, and that wrath was becoming sin and taking the punishment and bearing that punishment for the sin. And so he was obedient unto death. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, where it says that he became sin for us. He became sin for us, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 8. Verse 2, he hath led me and brought me into darkness, but not into light. And the S reads, he has driven me and made me walk in darkness and not in light. He's driven me. Kyle, in his commentary, says, the path of Jeremiah's life certainly lay through darkness, but was not wholly devoid of light, because God had promised him his protection for the discharge of his official functions. The complaint applies to all the godly to whom, at the fall of Jerusalem, no light appeared to cheer the darkness of life's pathway. What he's saying is his way was wrapped in dense darkness, and he cannot understand God's judgments. Job chapter 30, verse 26. It emphasizes the adversity and difficulty of the present calamity. It's impossible to fully understand for him to see this. He knows it's true, but it's hard to understand. And this goes beyond Jeremiah to Christ and points to his suffering and his death. Even his closest disciples could not understand why he should have to die. Afterwards, yes. When the Spirit of God was upon them, yes, they could understand. But not before. It goes beyond understanding for the natural mind. It's only spiritually discerned. See, the carnal mind out there, the unsaved, you talk about Jesus dying on the cross, it doesn't mean anything to them. They say, that doesn't make sense. It's only spiritually discerned. Verse 3, surely against me is he turned. He turneth his hand against me all the day. Rotherham reads, surely against me doth he again and again turn his hand all the day. Leitch says that Jeremiah speaks as a representative of his people. It seems like it's continuous punishment. The emphasis is grievous suffering that has come in a special manner by the hand of God. It points to the suffering of heart and soul as experienced by Jeremiah and Christ. Again and again he is turned. Verse 4, my flesh and my skin hath he made old. He hath broken my bones. This made old here, NAS, has waste away. And the verb means to wear out by rubbing. And so it's often used of old clothes. But itself has itself nothing to do with the idea of age. In other words, it's not because of age, but it gives the appearance of age. The famine, disease, sorrow, grief is shown taking its terrible toll upon the people. They waste away physically, mentally, and spiritually. Have you ever seen people who've really had gone through this type of thing? They look old. They look old. They look worn out. Broken my bones. Now, this is a figure representing great sorrow. And you compare Isaiah chapter 38, verse 13 here, and Psalm 51:10, and Job 30, verse 17. And the idea here is that of acute pain. While in the previous clause, it was the slow wasting of his strength as he pined away in grief. In contrast, here is the sharp, acute pain. And it has stronger emphasis here. Verse 5. He hath builded against me and compassed me with gall and travail. We're seeing a picture throughout this thing of what happened to Christ. Builded against me. NES has for the entire verse. He has besieged and encompassed me with bitterness and hardship. And the figure is that of a siege. Gall and travail have been used to surround and attack the city. So it's showing that it's more of a spiritual nature. A spiritual sieging is taking place.
What's gall?
Gall is a kind of a bitter... yes, but it, you know, it's made from a bitter herb or a bitter root. I'm not sure exactly which, but it's extremely bitter. No, the picture is of a siege, and what has surrounded him is the gall and the travail. Okay, in other words, bitterness and things that are really bitter, and travail. In other words, it's showing that it's not the siege that's being spoken of here is not so much a physical siege that's being referred to, but a spiritual or emotional siege around about him. Bitterness and travail is what has surrounded him as a siege. It's besieging him. The gall and travail shows the bitter suffering itself. And that's what's surrounding him. It's also interesting to note that on the cross, Christ was given vinegar mixed with gall. Now this was to, I think the gall may have had some medicinal value to it. But it was bitter, very bitter, difficult to take. It's a plant with a very bitter taste. And in and of itself, it's apparently poisonous. But mixed with vinegar or something else, it apparently had some kind of a medicinal value. You know, there are certain drugs, some of them drawn from plants, others that are man-made, that in and of themselves have taken, well, in fact, a lot of drugs are this way. They're poisonous. But they're helpful if taken in small amounts. People who have heart problems can... I think it is heart problems, take a very light dosage of strychnine, I think it is, and it stimulates the heart. If you take too much of it, I imagine it overstimulates the heart. And so gall was kind of had a medicinal value to it, but see, it was a very bitter thing, and in and of itself it was poisonous. Verse 6, and that's what compassed him. He hath set me in dark places as they that be dead of old. Now the dark places, this is probably showing Christ facing the eternal separation. He set me in dark places. It shows what happened to Christ as he became sin. Now you'll note that it says that he did not set them with those that are dead, but like or as them he set in dark places. So it doesn't show him going into Sheol or Hades or whatever you want to call it, but more probably what he faced in his mind in the garden and on the cross, what he faced, the feeling, the impact of what was going to happen to him, having been set in dark places. Verse 7. He hath hedged me about that I cannot get out. He hath made my chain heavy. This hedging is, NES has walled. He has walled me about. The suffering has him surrounded on every side, and there's no escape available. And he hath made my chain heavy. It emphasizes further that this is something which must be endured, and he is fettered to it. In other words, that being hedged about, and he's fettered to it. He's tied to it. He's chained to it. He can't get out of it. It's the cup that could not be passed from Christ. The cause is man's own sin. And the chain, in a sense, in this case, is Jesus' love and obedience to his Father to do his will and not his own. Because he was chained to God's will. In other words, he refused to be apart from the will of God. And that's what kept him fettered. Verse 8. Seeing he needed that. In and of himself, he didn't want to do it. Not my will, but thy will be done. If there be any way, let this cup pass. But he had committed himself to doing the will of God. This is an important point. Because the testing will come, and all we're going to have is the call and vision of God, and we're going to have to hold to what the will of God is. Because the will of man is going to say no. And if we have allowed in the past justification for our own self-will, then at this time, we'll also allow it. We've got to be chained to his will, locked into it, solid, unshakable, unmovable, the way Jesus was. See, he asked for the cup to pass, but God said no. God said no, it's not going to pass. It may also show what Jesus felt when God left him on the cross. Hedged about, I can't get out. He's made my chain heavy. And Jeremiah must have felt similar things as he prayed for Jerusalem and for their deliverance. But Babylon kept attacking. And Jeremiah may have felt as though God would not hear him at all. But God did hear him. It's just that he said no. You remember at one point in time he said, don't intercede for this people anymore. And he did intercede again, and God rebuked him for it. He said, there's no other way. They have to go through this. Another place in Scripture, at the very, very, very early in Jeremiah, we see, as it were, God's heart, and he says, what else can I do? This is the way. This is the only way. Now, he gave them opportunity all along the way, but he also knew that this was going to be the way. And he knew that there wasn't anything else he could do, because they wouldn't listen. Verse 9, he hath enclosed my ways with hewn stone. He hath made my paths crooked. Now, the hewn stone speaks of large cut stones used in forming a wall. It means that God has raised up insurmountable obstacles in the pathway of life, in Jesus' life. It's an insurmountable obstacle. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. It's insurmountable. The stone rolled into the mouth of Christ's cave when he died. It appeared insurmountable to the men outside. There's the stone. But the tomb is empty. It's not insurmountable to God. Same thing with Lazarus. There may come a point in time where all appearances, it appears that you are dead, or even the move of God is dead. And there'll be those that'll come up in unbelief and say, it stinketh. And he'll say, roll away the stone. Roll away the stone. That may happen. That may happen. Because the resurrection is far more glorious then. Verse 9. I guess we're in verse 9. Well, that's the problem. He hath made my paths crooked. I was looking at verse 7. I couldn't figure out why this didn't work. He hath made my paths crooked. That's Christ becoming sin for us. See, he walked the straight and narrow path. And he became sin for us. His path was made crooked. That's Jeremiah and Christ both being pictured here suffering judgment as though they were actually deserving of that judgment. And they're receiving these horrible things that they're not due. Verse 10, he was unto me as a bear lying in wait and as a lion in secret places. This is what it appeared to be. It shows God actively opposing his escape like a lurking bear or a lion lying in ambush. See, the suffering was ordained of God, and it had to be endured. God says that this is the path to life and glory. That's why to the world it's a savor of death unto death. But to those that believe, it's a savor of life unto life. It's the path we're being taken down, learning to love not our own lives even unto the death. That's from Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, the man-child. That's part of the testimony. That by the word of their testimony, by the blood of the Lamb, and they love not their own lives. And those lives, that word is souls, even unto the death. That's not easy for us to understand the cost. It's one thing to say it. It's one thing to say it. But he's going to take us there. That's what it says, the man-child is part of their testimony. Then that's where the man-child's going to go. And if you want to be the man-child, that's what you'll do. And in one sense, you say, well, I'm willing to give up my soul for death. But I tell you this, we don't fully understand what Jesus did. Now, I know that we will not be forced, as it were, to be in the garden and give up our eternal salvation. I don't think we'll be forced to do that. For one thing, we wouldn't be able to bear it, even though Christ has gone before. We're not going to be able to handle that, I don't believe. But we're going to have to die the way he died. Pick up the cross daily and follow him. And the cost is far higher than we think it is. It's far higher than we think it is. Verse 11. He hath turned aside my ways and pulled me in pieces. He hath made me desolate. Now Leitch says of verses 10 and 11. Suddenly, like a bear or a lion lying in ambush, the Lord seized him and tore him in pieces. Verses 1 through 12 are a vivid picture of the last days of Jerusalem. The frustration of all their plans, their panicky efforts to find some means of escape instead of surrendering unconditionally to Nebuchadnezzar, as the Lord had time and again demanded. It's a further emphasis here on judgment. It pulled me in pieces. And this judgment had come on Jerusalem and had torn the city apart, literally. And it's what they deserved. And Jeremiah is suffering for the same reason that Christ suffered, because he had the heart of God. And to see this happen is a very painful and difficult thing, to see judgment come on someone, particularly if you've known the answer for them and you've given them warning. You know, there's times like you would like to walk up to somebody and grab them by the shirt, by the collar, you know, and shake them and say, can't you see? Pay attention. You know, look, you see what's happening to your life? You know, let me, you know, like give you what I know and put it right in there so you can see. But you can't do it. I know I dealt with somebody. They made a certain decision. They're going to be out of the church because of the decision. God would give me a heart for this person, to pray for this person, to minister to him, to counsel him. And when they cut me off, because they did, they just basically, I said, do you want to talk? And they said, no, thank you. just cut me off. I went and was worshiping the Lord right after that, and he just came to me right in there. It was like, see, as a man sometimes, you find yourself in those situations, and men have learned to deal with hard situations like that, and basically they just go, well, that's the way it is, you know. But there I was worshiping before the Lord, a little more vulnerable. And all of a sudden the impact began to come upon me. And I began to feel pain of it. And God said, you really want my heart? You really want my heart? He did it a couple times in the midst of that dance. I had to say yes. I had to say yes. He had God's heart. And that's why he suffered so. And that's why Christ was a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, because he had God's heart and he suffered for the people of God. That's coming to a place of real selflessness. I know I'm not there. I want to be there. But it's a painful place. It's a painful place. Selfishness is a painful place too. But it's totally self-serving. And it's a different kind of painfulness. There's no good end to it. There's no help to anybody out of selfishness. Not even to yourself. Not in truth. And it's pain. So then it's pain without a purpose. But having the heart of God is having pain and suffering and grief and agony for the people of God. And it has a purpose. It works something good, both in you and others, because they'll see the heart of God and it'll affect them. You had a question, Paul? It also points here to Christ taking our judgment that was due us. It's a very unusual thing, you know. Even for a righteous man, it's hard that someone would die for that one. But see, what he gave up was far more. And he gave it up for us while we were yet in sin and loved us. It's like what Lanny shared one day from the pulpit. He said, advance coming to the cross. Remember that? He said, advance coming to the cross. I was faced to this with this decision. To go with a demon manifestation, you know, there's one person who was manifesting at him in a heavy way, or go with one that's manifesting angels at him. And he said, you think I went one way? Well, I didn't. I went with the angels. But see, what he knew he needed to do was to go and minister and meet the needs of the one with the demon manifestation. And that's not necessarily always so. It's just that he knew in that situation, well, advance coming to the cross, putting aside your wants, your will, your desire, your needs, and help others and have the heart of God for them. There's a time to minister, to receive ministry unto yourself, a time to rest. Jesus went away and rested with his disciples. But I think a lot of times we find ourselves to be far more selfish than we would like to admit. God's going to teach us, though, what it is to give of ourselves for him and to have his heart. Even a lot of the ministry that we do for other people, and this I don't mean to diminish or denigrate any ministry that you have done or I've done or anybody else has done, but it's not uncommon that the ministry that we do perform has behind it some selfish motivations. It makes us feel good that we can minister to other people. And in one sense, that's not improper. But it's not always out of this self-sacrificial heart. It's not always. We need to recognize that so that we can say, Jesus, I just need to be matured in this area, and I want to be matured in this area, and I need to grow in this area, and I need to be free of selfishness. Selfishness is probably one of the chief problems. That's why marriage is split up. Selfishness. If one member of a marriage will be totally selfless, the marriage will work. It may not be a pleasure. It may not be a joy for both. But it'll work. It'll work. It will. So that just tells you that if a marriage won't work, that one or both are not, or at least both then, are not selfless. They're selfish. That's the truth. It's like what a brother shared from the pulpit. You can't hurt a dead man. If we go and die on the cross, you can't hurt a dead man. I was talking with Lanny about that too, about hurts. He's got some real revelation on hurt. God has really fed him on hurt to know how it works. It really is a manifestation of selfishness if there's hurts left in your life. That's not a nice thing to face up to, because you think, well, wait a minute now. That person did hurt me. they did hurt me. God said, if you have aught against your brother. He didn't say, if you have hurt your brother, go to him. He said, if you have aught against your brother. He put the burden of responsibility on the one who has been, quote unquote, hurt. Now that doesn't seem like it ought to be. What do we like to do? They owe me an apology. I'm not going to talk to them until they apologize. That's it. They owe me an apology and I'm sticking to my guns. Yeah, well, kill yourself with your own guns, you know. That's the obligation is on the one who has been hurt by someone. That is selflessness. And the obligation isn't go to them and say, you better apologize to me. That's not the obligation. Make it right. Make it right. See, almost without a doubt, there's always complicity on the part of the one that's been hurt. They've been involved in it too. And in reality, we should not be harboring hurts at all. We shouldn't be. Forgive them as Christ forgave us. That's what it says in Scripture. If you forgive as Christ forgave us, then there is no hurt. Ooh, I guess I'm not very Christ-like yet then. That's the truth. That's what it boils down to. We're not very Christ-like yet. We're still selfish. We're still selfish. We want to hold those things in because we say, now look, I deserve to be apologized to. No, you don't. You deserve the lake of fire, except for the grace and mercy of God. And you've been forgiven. You've been forgiven, 10,000 talents? You've been forgiven 10,000 talents. This one owes you 100 talents. Or less. Verse 12. He hath bent his bow and sent me as a mark for the arrow. Cook in his commentary says, thus in every way God opposes the sufferer. When he is in the jaws of the lion and the hunter comes, it is not to save him. It is the poor fallen victim, not the beast of prey, which is the mark for his arrows. Here it is, under demonic attack, you know. Oh, Lord, save me. And God comes and turns up the heat. See, because the demons, it's our fault. It's the sin, see. This is, now, in Christ's case, it wasn't his sin. But for us, it is. We say, Lord, save us, you know. Keep your part of the covenant, even though I haven't. Keep your part of the covenant. But God comes to shoot the arrow in still. Because he wants us to be humbled and broken. Now, this is more particularly speaking of Christ, and it represents Christ. But it represents those who would be of Christ also. Job chapter 16, verse 2. We're going to have the joy of the Lord fully and completely and totally if we will walk with Him. We're going to have the joy of the Lord. But we're also going to have sorrows and grief, suffering, tribulation, trials, difficulties, problems. That's guaranteed. It is through much tribulation that we shall enter into the kingdom of God.
I didn't understand what you said about the lion having the prey in his mouth.
Well, this is the picture, apparently, that the lion has. This is what Cook feels is the picture. That the lion has the prey in his mouth. And the prey, speaking of a man in this case, is crying out, come save me. So the Lord appears with arrows. Only the arrows aren't for the lion. They're for the prey. See, because the judgment was deserved. We're deserving of the judgment. Now, as I said, Christ was not deserving of that judgment. But all those who walk with him are going to suffer unjust things. And they're going to suffer them with the same attitude that Jesus did. If they will be of Christ, if they will be of the man-child, if they will be of the bride, they will suffer them the way he did. He didn't deserve the suffering he received. Now, most of the suffering that we receive is deserved. It's because of demonic inroads in our life. It's because of unwillingnesses. It's because of sin in our life. Most of it's deserved. And it's as though at that point God comes to us when we're in the midst of those and we're crying out, Lord, help me out of this trial. And it's like he comes and turns the fire up. Why? Because he's trying to break us. He's trying to break us and cleanse us and purify us. Now also, this will happen with the man-child. And Job is also a picture, a type of the man-child. Job 16:2. 16:12, excuse me. I was at ease, but he hath broken me asunder. He hath also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces and set me up for his mark. Now Job was a righteous man, perfect in all his generation. And God did that to him. Why? To purify him. Job recognized it at points in time. He said, I know that when I come forth, I shall come forth as gold, having been purified in the fire. Well, that's what's going to happen to us. That's what's happening in this move. Things are popping. And they're popping all the time. Seems like there's not a moment's rest, you know? Well, the time is late. And God has got to purify his people and get them prepared. You know, we've been crying out for years. Jesus, we want holiness. We want purity. We want to be cleansed. We sing the songs year after year after year. I want holiness and purity in my life. I love Jesus. I'll go anywhere for you. I'll do anything for you, Jesus. Just anything you want, Lord, anything at all. And so he said, okay, I'm going to answer your prayers. And I'm going to answer them with a vengeance, as it were. He's going to answer them fully. They're affliction. They represent affliction. But they have a purpose. They have a purpose. The affliction has a purpose. See, in this case, God has been forced to become Judah's enemy in an active way. And it's completely opposite of God's heart and purpose. Now, in the typological picture, we have Christ. And it's as though God had become his enemy actively too. But it was for the reason that he was the source of salvation and he had to undergo that affliction that we might be forgiven. Someone had to bear the penalty. And so this affliction came upon him for that very purpose, that he might be bearing the penalty that was due us. Verse 13, he says, he hath caused the arrows of his quiver to enter into my reins. The reins are the kidneys, literally. NES has inward parts. In other words, the impact of all that is happening is going very deep. It's penetrated right to the heart, to the innermost being. The suffering, the affliction, the cost of it. Thus Jesus died of a broken heart. So his heart burst within him in pain for the affliction that was put upon him. Verse 14, I was a derision to all my people and their song all the day. Now this shows Jeremiah and Christ, and we saw this in Jeremiah's ministry, and we've seen it in Christ's ministry when you go through the Gospels. It shows them becoming objects of scoffing and mocking. And this is probably the real nature of the arrows. That's a hard thing to bear, particularly if you don't deserve it. Jerusalem was a derision to the nations, but they deserved it. But Jeremiah and Christ became this to their own people, and in the stead of those who deserved it. It became their song. Psalm 69, verse 12. They that sit in the gate speak against me, and I was the song of the drunkards. The idea is a mocking song. Being a byword, you know, in their mouths. Also, Job chapter 30, verse 9. Verse 15. He hath filled me with bitterness. He hath made me drunken with wormwood. Now, the bitterness is probably representing bitter sorrows. And the drunkenness, or drunken with wormwood, it shows drinking a cup of very painful suffering. That's the cup that he said. And I have to drink of that cup. And they said, we'll drink of it also. He said, you can't drink of that cup. And he said, but you will. They couldn't at the time, but they would later on. Once they'd been filled with the Spirit, once God had moved in their life and trained them and drawn them along, the apostles, the ones he was speaking to at that time, endured that same kind of bitterness, persecution in their life, the arrows, mocking, etc. And the wormwood plant here further emphasizes the bitterness of the whole thing. Verse 16, He hath also broken my teeth with gravel stones. He hath covered me with ashes. I might compare Proverbs chapter 20, verse 17 here. But Kyle says, you must view the giving of stones for bread as referring to cruel treatment. Clark says, instead of bread, being obliged to eat small pebbles till all his teeth are broken to pieces by endeavoring to grind them. Now, some say it's the grit, the gravel stones, it's the grit which gets into the portions of bread that are when they're baked in the ashes, which was an oriental way of preparing bread. It's not really clear exactly what it is. Might compare Matthew chapter 7, verse 9. Verse 17, and thou hast removed my soul far off from peace. I forgot prosperity. NAS reads, and my soul has been rejected from peace. I have forgotten happiness. Suffering of Jeremiah because of Jerusalem, the suffering of Jerusalem, and in type the suffering of Christ. Very painful, difficult situation. Verse 18, and I said, my strength and my hope is perished from the Lord. And when hope is gone, then man is truly lost. We've got to keep faith even in the darkest hour. There's always hope because God is the God of all hope. We can't ever come to the place where Job's wife said, curse God and die. In other words, you don't have any hope. You might as well curse God and die. We have to say instead, though he slay me, yet will I trust him, no matter what. No matter what, there's hope. Some are losing their hope. They're not seeing hope, and they see their hope as getting out of the situation they're in. Their hope is going through the situation they're in and coming out on the other side, trusting in God and hoping in him. See, there's a temporary hope, and this is what's so seductive. There's a temporary hope because if you jump out of the boat, you know, if it feels like the boat's on fire, you know, or you think it is, and you jump out of the boat, the water seems cool for a while, but there's sharks in the water, and you don't know how to swim very well, and the water's cold in reality, and you're going to suffer from hypothermia if the sharks don't get you. You know, I mean, it seems like that's the hope. But if the captain says, stay in the boat, and he's supposed to know what's going on, then you refuse the temporary hope, and you hope in the one who's leading. In this case, it's God who's leading us. And though he slay us, yet we will trust him. No matter what happens, we're going to trust him. There's always hope. Verse 19, remembering mine affliction and mine misery, the wormwood and the gall. NAS says remember instead of remembering. Remember my affliction and my misery, the wormwood and the gall. This is a prayer and a call to God for him to remember his people in this time of sorrow and difficulty. The word for misery here is better translated wandering or homelessness. When there's no hope, man is done for. Verse 20, my soul hath them still in remembrance and is humbled in me. In other words, he's remembering these things. He's remembering what was mentioned in verse 19, the misery, the wormwood and the gall, and it humbles him. This is a good thing. This is a good thing. Humility is a good thing. And how it comes is not pleasant always. In fact, it won't be pleasant because it doesn't fit with the natural man. But it's a good thing. For humbled, NES has bowed down. And Kyle has sinketh down. Leitch has depressed, although I suspect that depressed is not a really good translation of it. Humility is more what is in mind. It shows him experiencing deep agony and sorrow of soul. Verse 21, this I recall, to my mind. Therefore have I hope. Now what he brings back to mind is that he is now humbled. And when you're in a place of humility, you can have hope in God because you find out who you really are, and it gives you a much better view of who God is. He knows that God has seen his sorrow and remembered it. He knows that God hears his prayer. And he knows that God hears the prayer of the contrite, which is what he's been. He's been humbled. See, the humble and contrite of heart, God always hears their prayer. Always. And so he knows that. And he can begin to hope. So if we will humble ourselves, I guarantee that hope will come. This is part of the problem when people have no hope. What they're hanging on to is, it looks like, see, they want their own way. They want their own will. They don't want to admit that perhaps they have difficulties, that they have problems. They always want to blame it on somebody else. And they have no hope, you know. Nobody will listen to me. Nobody will answer me. Nobody will help me. No hope. When they humble themselves, then they are open and they can listen, and God can speak to them and bring them hope. Recalling calamities brings sorrow. And sorrow humbles his soul. And out of humility springs hope. And this is the way it is. It engenders hope. Verse 22. Now here we change. It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. Now when the hope springs up, what do we have? All of a sudden, brightness. This verse begins the center or the heart portion of the entire book. And this most important section culminates in verse 42. We have transgressed and have rebelled. Thou hast not pardoned. That's where it culminates. One man says, in them we find the riches of God's grace and mercy set forth in the brightest colors in this section. But no sooner are they ended than the prophet resumes the language of woe and again depicts his own and the people's sufferings in terms of the deepest anguish. And these verses represent the hope of verse 21. Mercies here is a word we've seen before. Chesed in compassions is racham. We've seen this before. Isaiah chapter 63, verse 7. See both these words in here. See a picture of God's heart. I will mention the loving kindnesses of the Lord and the praises of the Lord according to all that the Lord hath bestowed on us, and the great goodness toward the house of Israel which he hath bestowed on them according to his mercies and according to the multitude of his loving kindnesses. That's his real heart of compassion. That's what we can hope in. That's his mercies fail not. And the plurals, if you look in Isaiah 63:7, you see it's in the plurals, and you also see modifiers to it, making it multitudes of his loving kindnesses, or increased amounts. In other words, it's far more loving kindness and mercy than can possibly be expressed by language. That's the way it is. And it's of the Lord's mercies that we're not consumed. This mercies, either one of these words at times is translated as compassions, mercies, loving kindness, that kind of an idea behind it. And it's a very strong thing. Because his compassions fail not. That's our God. That's who we really serve. That's why we have hope. No matter what situation we're in, his compassions fail not. See, we would like to cry out and say, oh, why have you afflicted me so? Blaming God, you know. And in truth, he is, as it says in Psalm 66, he has caused men to reign over us, to rule over us. But it also says at the end of that, that he will bring us into a wealthy place. So we have hope in him. Verse 23 through 25. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. In other words, if you've expended all of his mercy for you in any given day, which is impossible in the first place, well, just let it be known that they're new the next morning. You have a fresh supply. That's the kind of heart he has. Infinite in his mercies toward those that are contrite and humble, those that will hope in him and trust in him. Great is thy faithfulness. Great. Again, it's a, you know, you can't express it. How great is his faithfulness? Well, he's infinite. He's unchanging. He's faithful. He'll never be blamed. The Lord is my portion, saith my soul. Therefore will I hope in him. God said that in the Word. It's good to remember the Word. He said that. He said it of the priests. He said, "The Levi is my portion, and I am Levi's portion." Levi didn't get an inheritance in the land. Instead, their inheritance was the Lord. Jeremiah was a priest, remember? The Lord is my portion. And we're all to be priests. That's what it said. That's what God wanted in the beginning. He wanted a kingdom of priests. In verse 25, the Lord is good unto them that wait for him, to the soul that seeketh him. And literally, this reads, good is Yahweh to those anointing him to the soul and to those seeking him. Good is Yahweh to those anointing him to the soul and seeking him. Verse 26, it is good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. This quietly wait here reads better as NES has it. It is good that he waits silently for the salvation of the Lord. It's good that he waits silently for the salvation of the Lord. Now, a number of commentators say that the silence means without complaining. And it shows man accepting God's will and God's means of producing salvation. In other words, no grumbling. And not following Israel's example of murmuring in the wilderness. Doing all things without disputings and without murmurings. Paul says in the epistles, I think it's in Ephesians. To hope and wait quietly. See, that's one of the hardest things we have. Man, it's like murmuring is born in man, and complaining is born in man. It really stems from that same selfishness. Oh, woe is me. Self-pity, you know. Complaining. My lot in life is so terrible, you know. It really stems from selfishness. Complaining does. And it's the good thing is that we hope quietly and wait. Have patience. We have need of patience. We have need of patience. Read in Hebrews chapter 12, I think it is. Talking about Jesus, who's the author and the finisher of the faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him, that is Jesus, that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. So we have need of patience for this. Why? Because ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. We have need of patience. We need to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Not a lot of this complaining. Now, it's all right to go to people and say, I need prayer, I need help. But you know, most of the time we go and say, this is, you know, so-and-so is treating me this way. And so, you know. In other words, we're always trying to get people on our side. Well, let it be known, God is on your side. And that's enough. Any complaints you have, take them to God. I have a suspicion what he'll do with them. He'll say, wait quietly for my salvation. Just sit and wait quietly. Now he that ruleth his tongue, the same as a perfect man. Or I guess it says, he that doesn't offend with his tongue is the same as a perfect man. And he that ruleth his spirit is better than he that taketh the city. Waiting quietly. In your patience, possess ye your souls. It's a good thing. Trains us to be like Christ. He waited patiently for the salvation. Even though on the cross, see, his promise was that he was going to be saved and kept safe. And he waited. He waited 3 days and three nights in the belly of the earth. He waited without complaint. Verse 27, it is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. Now, Kyle says of this youthful idea, It is also, and he refers back to the previous verses, good for man to bear a yoke in youth that he may exercise himself in calm waiting on the help of the Lord. In the present context, the yoke is that of sufferings, and the time of youth is the time of freshness and vigor, which render the bearing of burdens more easy. He who has learned in youth to bear sufferings will not sink in despair should they come on him in old age. But the yoke is probably another yoke too. There's a yoke of discipline. It's good to learn that in your youth. A lot of people struggle when they get older because they were never learned proper discipline. Like when they first come to Bible college and they can't study and they can't, you know, they fall apart. Because they never learned how to discipline themselves to study. It's difficult, I understand. And the devil, of course, works very hard at this to bring discouragement, etc. But we need to learn, we need to take the yoke of the Lord. It's easy. It's not easy on the flesh, but it's easy. In the spirit, it's easy. Christ took the yoke on himself, even at when he was a youth. Even at 12, he was already about his father's business. Jeremiah was called in his youth also. Now, at first, he didn't want the yoke. You remember? He said, I'm but a youth. He said, don't worry, I'll put my words in your mouth. Israel had been called in its youth also. Compare Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 2, chapter 3, verse 24 and 25. He called them from the very beginning, when they were youth in Egypt. See, God wants to train man from his youth so that when he gets old, he will not depart from it. Compare Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and he shall not, in the latter days or however it goes, it shall not depart therein. Train up a child properly. That's one of the problems that we have, is whether or not we were raised right. And if we were raised without discipline, see, that's something very hard to learn. It's very hard to learn later on. It's a very painful process. Yeah, it's painful when a kid is young, but you know they recover a lot faster than when you're old. It's difficult to learn when you're older. Verse 28. He sitteth alone and keepeth silence because he hath borne it upon him. Now this shows Christ. Isaiah chapter 53, verse 7. He bore it in silence. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. And he had every legitimate claim to opening his mouth and making claim against them for what they were doing. When they took him in, it was an illegal trial. They took him at night. They tried him at night, which was illegal also. They were supposed to wait 24 hours before they tried him, which was illegal also. They didn't have the right to condemn him for what they condemned him for. In other words, it was illegal all the way. And you know what? He didn't open his mouth. Matthew chapter 26, verse 63. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 7, we see that there is a time to keep silence. It's one of the hardest things for us to learn. To keep silence. I'm working very hard on it right now. To learn to keep my mouth shut when it doesn't need to be opened. That my tongue be not a world of iniquity set on fire of hell. The devil has used it too much for that. And I don't want that anymore. I don't want to give any occasion to him anymore. That's a hard thing to learn, to keep your mouth shut. It really is. Yeah. You sit there patiently and quietly taking abuse from somebody. And you feel really good. But then all of a sudden, they hit a trigger word, a trigger point, and there you pop something out. You know, maybe you say it very nicely and quietly too, but you know, it's like, well, you know, and off they go again some more, see? It's hard to learn that. It's hard to be like Christ and let them rail on you and keep your mouth shut. A pastor gave an example of that, how a man came up to him at his door and did that to him. And he just stood there, and he shared some things with the man. But basically, he just stood there, and he didn't try and defend himself. Even though he was, you know, the man was verbally abusive. And he also threatened him. He just stood there. That's a hard thing to do. Take note of that, and we'll and learn of it ourselves. We'll continue on Monday. Did I forget to pass the roll book out?
Yep, I did. Huh? Did I?
No,
I didn't. So, quick assignment.
Julie left. So, somebody wants to put a JP in there or something, whatever.